What is up, everybody? Welcome back to season 3 of Environmentality. What is up, everyone? Welcome back to season 3 of Environmentality. I'm going to be kicking us off today with the first installment of a series I have been working on for about a year now on everybody's favorite vice, favorite beverage. You know it, you smell it, you love it, you're addicted to it, coffee. So today I'm going to be bringing you the first installment, which is going to be about the botany and the horticulture, the really nerdy plant stuff that I like about coffee. But in the coming weeks, each week I'll be releasing an episode about sustainable coffee. And each week we'll be interviewing a different person in the supply chain about coffee. So we have interviews about the sustainable production of coffee and what it looks like on the farm and the processing and the roasting and then the retail side of things and then looking at different post-harvest management techniques, how farmers and roasters are manipulating their coffee and how that translates to the different chemical profiles and the notes and the aromas and the flavors that we're getting. So we're going to be diving into every nook and cranny about coffee and how we can be supporting the coffee industry. How can we be supporting the farmers that are producing it? And take a look into the science, the deep level of science that's being invested and investigative about coffee. So sit back, relax, maybe grab yourself a cup of the beverage we are going to be discussing over the next several weeks. A little black cafe, a little cappuccino, a little latte with oat milk, of course. And sit back, relax, and enjoy the show.
Welcome to Environmentality, a podcast for current environmental news, lectures, and interviews with the experts. I'm your host, Brendan Anthony. Let's dive on in.
You know, I've been drinking coffee for about almost 10 years now. I grew up hating the taste of it. I think every kid did. You know, it was something that was really bold and dark and rich and bitter and acidic. And I think it was a bit overpowering as a kid. But, you know, as you grow older, your palate changes. And I think the cool thing about coffee is that it's so steeped and embedded with culture, experiences, conversations, and now comedians and cars. Shout out to Jerry Seinfeld. But, you know, there's just such an experience and a community that surrounds coffee. And I think that's why so many people are drawn to it. You know, the best conversations are had over a cup of coffee. You know, the places where coffee is grown are the most beautiful places in the world. And being able to walk on a coffee farm is a really rich experience. You know, for me, the first time I fell in love with coffee was in El Salvador, and I started drinking it. And, you know, at first I was dumping sugar and milk and all these things to mask the coffee just to be able to get the energy and suck it down. But by the end of 2 weeks, you know, you start to appreciate. And I think more than that, when you get to experience and walk the farms where it's produced in some of these landscapes, you now start to appreciate the sheer production and the sheer volume that this crop is produced at around the world. And, you know, that's largely due to the demand being so high. And I think that's true of any agricultural product. And this is why I'm so big about wanting people to be more engaged in their food system, because I think when you meet the farmers, you see how things are being produced and grown, the level of appreciation is just elevated. And as a result, you're probably less inclined to waste the food. You're more inclined to pay more for that product and support the farmers that are doing this tremendously hard work to get a product to you conveniently at an affordable price, at a high quality, and meets all the food safety guidelines, right? That's not an easy task, all while trying to do it in a way that doesn't degrade the natural resources of our planet, right? This is the idea of what sustainable agriculture is. To be able to produce an affordable, healthy, nutritious, safe product while not degrading the environment or even helping benefit the environment, right? And now we talk about regenerative agriculture and agroecology. And I think, you know, it's so difficult. And I think we take it so for granted in our daily lives. And I think these were the types of motivations that wanted me to produce a body of content that helped explain and highlight and showcase the tremendous challenges that, in particular, coffee producers in the coffee industry faces, and to try and instill an appreciation for this product that we're all so intricately connected with on a daily or maybe on an hourly basis for some of us. So that's kind of the motivation and my story with coffee. I've been a barista. I have, you know, worked and helped coffee producers. I have learned from a lot of coffee producers all around the world in different countries. And I've just grown such an appreciation for this crop. As a plant, it's really cool. But obviously as a product, it's very much so a part of my life. And I would assume it's probably a part of yours. And it's something that I think if we are all connecting with and engaging with on a daily basis, then the volume of impact that we can have as consumers can be far greater, right? And this is why I'm so also really excited about talking about environmental issues as they pertain to food, because all of us are a part of the food system, right? You don't need to be a farmer to be a part of the food system. Consumers are arguably the most important aspect of a food system. And if every day you're eating three times a day or consuming beverages throughout the day, right? This is your greatest volume impact or opportunity to help change things for the better, to take care of the environment with every bite or beverage you consume. And so this is all about education and better understanding the situation, the context, and how you can use your dietary choices to help have a positive impact, not only on the planet, but for certain farmers, right? And the people that are also part of this food system, right? We're all connected in this food system. So that's a little bit of again, an anthology of my story and background and desire of why I wanted to produce these episodes, talking to really amazing people. Man, I had so much fun talking to all of these people who are invested in coffee and so passionate about coffee, right? Different scientists and growers and coffee shop owners. And it was such a blessing to me, and I learned a lot. So I hope you guys all learn a lot as well. So let's go ahead and jump into some of the nerdy plant stuff, the botany, the horticulture, and just a little bit of a background again on coffee so you can be primed on, you know, what this tree is, some of the issues they're facing. And of course, we'll dive into all those issues in the upcoming episode. So I won't get into too deep on any particular topic here. Just want to provide a little bit of a primer and an introduction to the What is Sustainable Coffee podcast series. So thanks for tuning in. Let's go ahead and take a little break and we'll be back with my lecture. All right, everyone. So for those who don't know, coffee is grown on a tree. I know that sounds simple, but a lot of people don't even know that pineapples are grown on bushes, right? I think people think pineapples grow on trees. So I don't know. I never know where people think things grow on. So for those who don't know, coffee is grown on a tree. It's a shorter, smaller tree that we've now kind of bred to be a little bit more compact. You know, very rarely will it grow above 7, 8, 9, 10 feet, right? So this is a more compact tree, what we would consider a pedestrian tree, where you don't necessarily need a lot of ladders to manage it. And that's largely due to the fact that coffee is a shade grown plant. And I'll get more into that in just a moment, but I want to back up and just give a little bit more botanical information. The scientific name for coffee is Coffea arabica. This is the more common species of coffee that we all love and drink and consume. About 60 to 80% of all the coffee produced and consumed is Coffea arabica or Arabica coffee. The alternative is the Robusta or Robusta coffee, which is Coffea canephora. This is a different species. Okay, so same genus, same plant family, but it's a different species and it's a Robusta species. And about 20 to 40% of the production worldwide is this alternative species. And I'll compare and contrast them a little bit more in just a moment. Both of these species are in the plant family, the coffee family, known as Rubiaceae. So all plant families have this ACA ending. So Rubiaceae is the coffee family. That's where you can find the Coffea genus, in which you have two species, Arabica and Conifora, Arabica being the predominant species that we consume. The largest producers of coffee right now is Brazil and Vietnam. And the origin of where coffee is, you know, more or less native to or endemic to is always kind of being debated. Most people will say that Ethiopia is the origin species, although there's some distinctions and controversy that maybe perhaps it came from Yemen. However, for the most part, it's thriving and more native to tropical Africa and in Asia as well. So again, Brazil and Vietnam are the largest producers, although Ethiopia is still a very major producer of coffee today. So I want to provide a little bit more of a distinction between Coffea arabica, the Arabica type or species, and Coffea canephora, the Robusta species, in that Arabica is going to be considered the more sweeter, softer, easier to drink coffee. It's typically going to be more aromatic, and it's going to give the flavor profiles that most folks are familiar with and are enjoying, the more fruity, floral type of aromas. Although, of course, all of these chemical aroma type profiles can be shifted based on the environment it's grown in and the altitude and then how it's roasted, right? So all these things are manipulatable, but for the most part, these are the general distinctions. So you have Arabica that's sweeter, easier to drink, and then you have Robusta, which is harsher and stronger, more bold, and typically has a higher caffeine content in the Robusta versus the Arabica as well. And so this is largely the biggest difference between these two, although again, the different varieties of each species and the environment are going to play tremendous roles in the ultimate flavor profiles that are going to be experienced by the consumer. And lastly, I'll just say that Arabica typically is grown at higher elevations than Robusta. And again, that environment plays into the flavor profile. Coffea Arabica is typically self-pollinated, meaning that it can pollinate its own flower. So the pollen from one of the flowers on its tree can then land on the stigma or the tip of the female part of the plant that produces then the cherry or the berry within the bean or the seed inside. And so when we think about a coffee fruit, it's classified as a berry, which is just a fleshy fruit with a seed inside. And so when we are grinding up coffee beans, they're actually the seeds of the coffee berry or cherry, as we've come to call it, because of the red flesh or the red skin. And this is the fruit part. So when you pollinate the flower of a coffee tree, it's going to produce a red berry. And inside you get the seed. And so Coffea arabica, the flowers that are on the single tree can pollinate each other. Now, when you think about other fruit species, like apples, for example, typically you need cross-pollination. And this is a evolutionary advantage for most trees to try and shuffle the genetic deck. Meaning if you can take pollen from one variety and mix it with the pollen or the flower of another variety, then the seeds that are going to be developed in that fruit are going to be genetically unique from the parents. It's like how humans are born, right? You have a little bit of genes from your mom and your dad, and you're going to get a unique individual. So same species, just a different cultivar. And so for Coffea arabica, you don't require that cross-pollination. So the genetic diversity stays more narrow, right? There's less diversity. But as a result, you can propagate these plants from seed because the seed is going to be genetically identical to the tree it came from. However, Coffea canephora, the Robusta species, requires typically cross-pollination. And so in this context, you are shuffling the genetic deck, right? Because you're getting pollen from perhaps a different cultivar. And as a result, propagating from seed for these cultivars are going to be much more challenging because you might get an entirely different cultivar that you wanted, right? And you might want to maintain that cultivar identity because it might have great quality, it might be able to yield a lot, it might have disease resistance, right? All these characteristics that you might have in an ideal cultivar. And so it's more difficult to propagate these. And so typically what you'll need to do if you want to maintain the genetic identity of a Robusta species, you need to propagate vegetatively. And that means like cutting a branch off and trying to self-fruit it or graft it onto another type of rootstock. And then that way you can preserve the genetic identity of that cultivar. Now, before I go too deep into the botanical woods and lose some of you, let me just break that down in a way that we can better comprehend. So when we think about scientific classification, you have a family, a genus, a species, and then in plants in particular, you have different cultivars or varieties, which are just different unique individuals that are all of the same species. If I were to liken that to humans, right, you have our genus species, which is Homo sapiens, right? And then all of the different people that we have, right? These were all technically different cultivars, right? Or different individuals or varieties or variations of what a Homo sapien, a human, looks like or behaves and different characteristics that we might have, right? So in the same way, plants, you can have the same species and then different varieties within that species. So Arabica, one species. Canephora or Robusta, which is like the common name, is a different species. And in the Arabica species, we have several unique cultivars. And these cultivars are all, again, being bred for different characteristics that would be helpful for production or for returning a high profit. So then focusing on the quality. And so just to give some examples of different cultivars, in the Arabica species, you have Typica, which is probably one of the most culturally, genetically important varieties in the world with exceptional quality coming out of Central America. However, because it's been around for so long, dating back to like the 1300s, it's highly susceptible to a lot of the modern day diseases that we struggle with, like coffee leaf rust or coffee berry borer, which we'll talk at length about in the upcoming episodes. But again, this is coming from the very native, original Ethiopian coffees. It has kind of lower yields, right? They weren't being bred for high production back then like we are today, given that the demand is so high, but the quality is excellent. And so many of the varieties that we have now are coming from parentage stemmed in Typica. So it's Caffea Arabica Typica is the variety. Now, one of the mutations from Typica is called Bourbon or Bourbon. And this is what's called a sport variety, meaning that there was just some natural mutation that happened with the genetics. There was maybe one branch of a Typica tree that looked different, had maybe bigger berries or whatever it might be, redder color, higher yields, etc. And the grower realized that, cut off that branch, and then started propagating that individually. And that's how we got Bourbon, which is from the 1860s. And when I was in El Salvador, and you'll hear from Giancarlo himself, he loves bourbon and he's been growing it on some of those farms that he has for 100+ years, right? So this is from the 1860s. So some of those trees are coming from, you know, early 1900s when this was a really popular variety. Again, this is one of the more original varieties in more modern day coffee production. It's grown worldwide, but it's very popular in Latin America and in El Salvador, where I got to see it up close and personal. It has excellent quality and it cups really well, especially when it's grown at high altitudes. Now, some varieties are coming actually from the hybridization of Caffea Arabica and Caffea Canephora. So the two major species in the coffee genus were then bred together. And when you breed two different species, you get a hybrid, right? So something like a lion and a tiger, you get a liger, right? So this is the same type of thing. So you get the Arabica and the Canephora together and you get what's called a Timor hybrid. And this cross was done in the 1930s because we know a lot about what's called hybrid vigor. When you hybridize, you typically get some sort of advancement in the genetics because you're getting the best of both worlds, so to speak. And so this was primarily cultivated for disease resistance and became really popular to breed with for resistance to coffee leaf rust, which is a major pathogen, fungal pathogen, which again, we'll talk more at length about in the upcoming episodes. And so a lot of the breeding that's being done now to develop new coffee cultivars are being done to target disease resistance. And so the Timor hybrid was one of these, and this was done back in the 1930s. Now, another big evolution in tree production And this goes for many different types of tree fruit species, especially when we think about apples and cherries and pears and peaches, right? It's this idea of having high density plantings. And if you go to the last episode of season two, I talk at length about what are high density orchards and what are high density tree plantings. And so now a lot of the coffee breeding, as I mentioned, has been focused on disease resistance, but it's also being targeted towards dwarfism. And how can we get trees smaller so we can plant them closer together and get larger production on a per acre or per hectare basis, on a per land unit area basis, as opposed to having this enormous or bigger trees that might produce a lot per tree, but they're not as efficient with the space and the resources. And so if we can plant smaller trees closer together, we get higher efficiency and a bigger yield on a per land unit area. So one of the varieties that was being bred for dwarfism is a variety called Catura. And it's a compact plant, has great yield potential, you know, pretty standard quality, although it's very susceptible to coffee leaf rust. So again, how can we start to breed all of these things together? How can we start to breed a magic elixir or a silver bullet of coffee attributes like dwarfism, disease resistance, high yields, high quality, right? This is the goal of a lot of modern breeding for all types of tree species. And so coffee is no exception. This is one of the most economic varieties now in Latin America, again, because you can plant it so close together and it produces high yields. But the problem is that, again, it's highly susceptible to both coffee leaf rust and coffee berry disease. Coffee berry disease is not yet really prevalent in Latin America, which is great, but coffee leaf rust is a huge issue. Then the question starts to be asked, right? As I mentioned before, can we start breeding these all together so we can get a nice combination where we get the dwarfism, where we get the disease resistance, where we get the good yields? And so this is showing the advancement of how breeders are thinking. And in 1959, we have the origin and the cross of Catura, the dwarfing cultivar, and the Timor hybrid, right? That hybrid between the two different species that had good disease resistance. So the cross between two of these cultivars generated a new variety called Catimor. And Catimor was produced in Portugal, again, as I mentioned, in the late 1950s, had great yields, great disease resistance, had more of that dwarf compact tree shape, and had great quality. So again, you start to see the combination of all of these breeding traits to get a really unique variety that kind of satisfies a lot of the desires that growers and consumers desire. And this is more commonly found in Malawi, Zambia, Zimbabwe. So this is more of an African variety. Just a couple more cultivars that are really popular in El Salvador and in Latin America. We have Pacas. And Pacas comes from one of the bourbon trees, again, which was, you know, from the 1800s. So this was, again, another sport mutation, another sport variety that was found by the Pacas family. And so that's where we get Pacas. And this was in El Salvador back in 1949. It was a highly dwarfing tree. It had great yields and great quality, but again, highly susceptible to coffee leaf rust. And this is a huge issue because 25% of all of El Salvador's coffee production is Pacas. And so when you think about the susceptibility of a coffee industry, you need to have resilience. And the way to have resilience is having species that are going to be great yields and quality, but also have disease resistance. And so this is where you need to have more modern breeding taking place and not using varieties that are 160 years old and try to have new varieties come out that have all the benefits without the cons, like the susceptibility to coffee leaf rust. Next, we have Marigohipe. Marigohipe is a natural mutation from the Tipica, which again was the godfather coffee variety from the 1300s. Marigohipe was, again, another sport variety that was found in 1870, but it's very, very tall. It's a very large tree, and it has these unusually large leaves, large internodes, the spacing between the leaves, and large beans, or the seeds within the fruit. And so this is a really unique variety because it has these huge seeds, but it's a very big tree, and so it's highly vigorous. And of course, it's also susceptible to coffee leaf rust and coffee berry disease. Again, two major fungal pathogens. And so again, the question must be asked, what if we could take a really small dwarfing tree like Pacas and cross it with a big seed variety like Marigohipe and blend these two things together to get the attributes that we want, like a small tree with large beans? And that was exactly what happened in 1958 when the cross between Pacos and Mario Hipe came together for Pacamara. Pacamara has large bean size from, you know, the Mario Hipe, so you get great high yields, but then it has the excellent cupping quality and the high value coming from the Pacas. And so it becomes this quote unquote perfect blend of these two characteristics. Although again, the pathogens become a huge problem. So for the most part, breeding is being done historically for high yields and quality. Disease resistant wasn't as big of an issue because we would just spray a lot of chemicals, right? We had fungicides, we had all these things, but then you start to have resistance to these chemicals. And then you get these, you know, mega diseases that now chemicals aren't as effective on. But also we start to think more about the environment and the impact that these chemicals have on the environment itself and the wildlife nearby. And so now breeding is really focused on disease resistance so we can start to minimize our application of chemical inputs. And so in this way, we can have the high yields and the high quality that we want for profitability, the economic E and the three E's of sustainability. But then we need to think about the environmental, right? Another E in the sustainability stool. And so if we can now start to think about breeding these characteristics into the trees that have high quality and high yields, then we can get, again, our silver bullet, our perfect tree, which will never fully exist. There's always trade-offs in breeding. But these are the desires and the avenues and the pursuits that breeders are focused on, to which I do want to give a disclaimer. I'm not a breeder by any means. I am very bad at genetics. I'm just a plant lover, a horticulturalist, and so I just wanted to provide some information on these unique varieties. So when you go to the coffee shops, you go to your roaster, look for these unique and very delicious and excellent varieties. There are hundreds, if not thousands more out there. So this is by no means an exhaustive list, but these are just certain ones that I've had unique interactions with on farms in Latin America and in the Caribbean. And so I just wanted to provide some interesting perspective on how cultivars are being bred and the focus of these, and again, how they can be focused on pursuing sustainability in the new development of coffee varieties. Okay, so let's jump back and do some more of the horticultural aspects of coffee. As I mentioned before, it's a smaller tree. Maybe it's more of a large shrub, honestly. The max it's really getting is about 9 to 11 feet. For the most part, these are pedestrian trees, meaning you can reach them from the ground. You don't need ladders. And the reason why is because this is a shade-grown tree species. So what I mean by that, when I talk about shade-grown trees, and you hear all about these shade-grown certifications, it's because this is an understory tree, right? So it's smaller in size, and it's going to be grown under the canopy of, you know, a more native forest. And so the reason it's a shade grown, or that term is used for species like coffee or cacao, is because the minimum amount of light that is required to stimulate photosynthesis is much lower than other species. So if we can take a little trip back to sixth grade biology for a moment, we can think about two inverse reactions. Photosynthesis, which uses water and CO2 to create oxygen and sugars, and respiration, which then uses those products, sugars and oxygen, to then go through metabolic function. And as a byproduct, CO2 and water are expelled. And so because these two are inverse of one another, when the plant doesn't have enough light for photosynthesis to catalyze that reaction, the plant is going through respiration. When a leaf is then stimulated with light, with what we call photons, then photosynthesis can be triggered. And so there's a minimum amount of light required to get above that point of respiration into photosynthesis. And at photosynthesis, then you can start to generate all these sugars and products that the plant needs to grow and survive and to develop fruit and seed, etc. That point where there is a minimum amount of light required to shift the plant from respiration to photosynthesis is called the compensation point. And the compensation point is much lower in shade-grown species as opposed to what would be a sun-grown or a light-loving plant species. below this compensation point, a plant will die because it's never going to have the capacity to generate the energy it needs to grow and survive. Once you have enough light to get above the compensation point, the plant can grow. Now, of course, there are saturation points where if the light is too excessive, the plant shifts again. It can't utilize all that light and it starts to go through protection type mechanisms or defensive type mechanisms where it's now investing in developing waxy layers to prevent water from escaping or creating kind of pubescent hairs to reflect the light away from the leaf, right? So these are defensive mechanisms to avoid excessive light. And so that is known as the saturation point. And so again, with shade grown species, the saturation point is also much lower than other sun-loving plants. It doesn't need as much light to kickstart photosynthesis, but at excessive levels of light, it shuts down and starts to go into defense mode as opposed to thriving as a beautiful tree, producing lots of beautiful coffee for all of us to enjoy and drink. And so hopefully that wasn't too intense. That was some plant physiology for my plant nerds out there. But this is what is known as a shade-grown species. And so this is why a plant or a tree is known as a shade-grown species, because it doesn't need as much light. That's my too long, don't read, TLDR, one-sentence summary. Shade-grown species doesn't need as much light to survive and thrive. And so this is why you need to plant forest or native forest trees above the coffee trees to provide them some of that protection and to intercept some of that light so not all the light hits the coffee tree directly. This has the added benefit when we think about ecology and diversity in our agricultural systems or our ecosystems, because when you have all that diversity, then you have more habitat, more ecosystem function, right? So the plethora and diversity of species in an ecosystem or an agricultural system is going to be a beneficial thing. And so when you see these certifications talking about shade grown, this is the reason why. The coffee is going to be more successful because it's living in much more ideal environments. But it's also benefiting the ecology of the system by having a more diversity of species so that you can provide a more diversity of ecosystem function and habitat for wildlife. Some of these certifications, as we all know, Rainforest Alliance, OOTS, which are now actually merged together. You have bird-friendly coffee coming out of the Smithsonian, where again, you're planting certain species to provide shade that are beneficial for bird habitat. So all of these types of certifications that we see and hear about are really targeting these ecological benefits for these trees. Now, there's CAFE practices, fair trade, equal exchange, right? All these other things are looking at more social elements as well, making sure that the farmers are producing enough money and income to support their families. There are many different types of certifications. They all have slightly different bends, but for the most part, they're focused on social and environmental issues. And we'll again talk more at length in the episodes to come about these certifications. Now, these certifications are by no means silver bullets, right? Just as there is no perfect tree that has all of the characteristics we want, there's no perfect certification, right? These are human constructs and there's holes and people can take advantage of them, right? A lot of the accountability goes out the window when you don't have auditors there, right? So these are not perfect labels. And in some cases, some farmers who have no labels or no certifications is actually going to be more sustainable than a farmer who does have all the certifications. And so it becomes a really nuanced thing. This is something that we talk a lot about in upcoming episodes, especially when we talk about production and post-harvest management. So I know so often me as a consumer, I want to just like look for a label, know it's going to be good and live in that ignorance and in that bliss, knowing that the product I'm buying is great, but it's not always so easy. And that's where relationships with our producers and relationships with the people who are growing the food and growing the product is going to be the best way to know how the environment and the people are being treated. And so we talk a lot about relationship coffee or coffee in relationship. And I think this is really going to be the major take home of the series in that we need to be educating ourselves and stimulating relationships where we can, whether that's with our coffee shop owner, our roaster, and if you have the luxury or privilege, the coffee producer as well. And so that's my little foreshadowing on the nuances and complexity of certifications. And I'm excited for you to hear the totality of those conversations in the weeks to come. So let's take one last little break here, and I'm going to come back and close this horticultural lecture on coffee up with caffeine. caffeine is probably why most of us drink coffee, to keep us awake, right? It gives us energy. We get a little bit of a high, right? This is the chemical, or quote unquote, the drug that's giving us the more or less addiction to the coffee that we love to drink and consume. So how is the plant using caffeine? Why did caffeine evolve, and why is caffeine a part of plants today? Now, caffeine is certainly not exclusive just to coffee. Other species have caffeine in it, right? We think about chocolate and cacao has caffeine as well. Caffeine is what is known as a secondary plant metabolite. So plants have these metabolites, or these chemicals that they synthesize and compounds that they synthesize for various different tasks. You have primary metabolites, which are focused primarily on survival, things like sugars, amino acids, right? These are the building blocks of proteins and the more fundamental metabolites that are used for growth and survival. When we think about secondary plant metabolites, these are more focused on plant defense and focus on other things that are not necessarily necessary for survival, but they certainly help the plant to perform better and be more competitive in a dog-eat-dog ecosystem. And so caffeine is a chemical inhibitor for, one, other plants, right? It can help decrease competition for resources. The caffeine in the coffee tree can thwart the growth of other plants that are growing nearby. So it can take all the water, take all the nutrients, and maximize its space in the ecosystem. But it's also a chemical inhibitor for insects, particularly herbivorous insects that may want to try and eat the leaves or the tree or the flowers. And the reason why is because if a small little insect were to take a bite of, let's say, the berry of the fruit, because typically a big ripe red berry is very attractive for birds or for insects. And so if an insect were to go and take a little bite out of that, they would get a super high dose of caffeine, relative obviously to the size of the insect. And this is going to be very toxic, and this can kill the insect, and this will certainly deter other types of insects from trying to consume and damage the plant by eating it. And so this is, again, a chemical inhibitor for other plants and other predatory insects that might want to try and snack on the leaves or the fruit of a coffee tree. But when we think about other benefits to caffeine, we see it as a way to attract pollinators. Because the bees, when they come to pollinate the flowers, they're not necessarily eating the flowers, right? They're just kind of rolling around in the pollen, rolling around in the flower to try and get the nectar. And throughout this process, the bees get a little dose, a smaller dose, not a toxic, deadly dose of caffeine, but a small enough dose to give it a little buzz, to give it a little high. And this is certainly going to be something that's beneficial for the bees. And in the same way, this is why humans love coffee, right? We get a little buzz, we get a little high, we're able to get all of our work done. Same thing for the bee. They're able to fly faster, be more focused, go from flower to flower, right? They're getting the added benefits of caffeine that we do as well. Pollinators are going to get a healthy dose of caffeine, which is going to then continue to attract more and more pollinators. And caffeine certainly does have a scent. And this is how pollinators are going to be able to find the flowers and find the coffee species to be able to do its pollinating job. And I will say that the flowers of coffee are super fragrant as well. So if you ever had the pleasure to walk a coffee farm in full bloom, definitely just go in with your nostrils wide open. But all that to say, caffeine, again, is this amazing metabolite or chemical compound that's used for defense and for offense, to thwart predation, to thwart resource competition, and at the same time attract pollination so that it can continue to develop seeds that can then be used for reproduction. Because ultimately, in the animal and plant kingdom, this is the goal of life, to survive long enough to reproduce. So that's caffeine. And that's how it ultimately won us over. And this is why we are now growing millions and millions of trees of coffee trees all around the world. If I were to take a plant-centric perspective, as Michael Pollan loves to do in his book, The Botany of Desire. So I'm going to leave it there. This has hopefully been a nice little snapshot, an introduction into the world of coffee, some of the environmental and social issues that is facing the industry today, some of the unique characteristics of different cultivars and chemical compounds and production systems that coffee is evolving and having and maintaining and is characterized by today. So I'm going to go ahead and pause this lecture here. I hope to see you next week as we start to embark on this journey in the coffee supply chain from tree to cup. I'm Brendan Anthony. This is Environmentality, and thanks for tuning in.